Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from the unceded ancestral territory of the Halkamilaman Squamish-speaking people who have been here since time immemorial, living, gathering, sharing stories and music and culture. And I'm very grateful to be able to do the same thing, my own version of that here.
And welcome to the Monday edition of Speak Up. Thanks to Jesse for that land acknowledgement. My name is Magnus Tiewold, and I'm your host for this hour of Speak Up. It's Monday, October the 20th. We have a bunch of interesting stories for you today. We have a report from our reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, about a new exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver, entitled Living with Long COVID. We also have a report from Northern BC, from our friends at CICK Radio in Smithers, about truth and reconciliation in Wet'suwet, which is a Wet'suwet'en community in Northern BC, about the future of Wet'suwet'en youth. So that'll be coming up in about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes. We have, of course, our regular segment, Gardening with Embark, and Peter Arich will be here at the end of the program with his topic of the day. So in the news these days, couple stories, of course, here in BC. The BC government strike, a strike by the BC General Employees Union, which represents government workers, is continuing, although it is now heading towards a non-binding arbitration among the folks who will be not arbitration, but rather non-binding mediation. And among the folks leading that mediation effort is Vince Reddy, who's been pretty much at the forefront of labor mediation efforts here in British Columbia. Just about every major dispute where they need a mediator to step in, he's the guy who is tapped for that. Government workers have been on strike for 7 weeks, which is quite a long strike. I'm sure it's difficult for those who are missing out on government services they're hoping to get to. I'm sure it's also very difficult for the striking workers themselves. That's a long time to be off the job and without a paycheck. Although it hasn't been, it's been rotating strikes and stuff like that for part of that period at any rate. But nevertheless, difficult for everyone involved. And so hopefully we'll see a resolution of that soon if that process goes well. In Palestine and Israel, the ceasefire that was brokered a couple weeks ago with the important intervention of Donald Trump is holding, but barely. On the weekend, there was what the Israelis are claiming was an incident in which their soldiers were shot at from a position, and the Israelis responded with airstrikes. A couple Israeli soldiers were killed, and almost over 40 Palestinians were killed. One of the things that's, I was reading about the war that was going on now, and is at least currently, hopefully it will stick for the moment, in a ceasefire, is that one of the Israeli sort of tactical approaches they've been doing is whatever else they do, they've been acting in a way to absolutely minimize casualties to their soldiers, which is why they've relied so heavily on airstrikes. It's an interesting choice to use airstrikes all the time. When you think how small the Palestinian, the Gaza territory is, I know with, modern weapons technology, aerial strikes can be remarkably precise. And perhaps you've seen a couple of the, some of the videos of strikes during the war, where an airstrike would precisely target the foundation of a tall tower block, residential tower block, and bring the whole thing down with a single strike. And that speaks to a lot of the precision with which they can land the bombs. At the same time, you know, one of the problems with airstrikes is, of course, you can only be as precise as the information you're working on. And it would appear a lot of times it's like, you know, we vaguely know there's some folks over there who were shooting at us, and they drop a lot of really big bombs. And inevitably, there's a lot of going to be a lot of collateral damage. You may actually hit the fighters you're targeting, but it seems inevitable that, and it is, in fact, the fact that a lot of civilians, Palestinian civilians, are killed as well. You know, that number of over 40 killed represents mostly civilians and perhaps a few fighters. We didn't get any specific breakdown around what that might have looked like. But, you know, that's how we end up at a number of 65,000 casualties over the 2 years of this war. So hopefully, you know, that's a pretty big incident threatening the ceasefire from news reports. There's been significant intervention from both the White House and some of the other Arab states, which were supporters of the ceasefire, some of which have diplomatic relations with Israel, to pressure Israel to back off a bit on that. And hopefully it holds. I don't think we need to see a return to that killing. Efforts to end the war in Ukraine don't seem very hopeful to me. There's more talks between the White House and Russia, and then the White House and Zelensky of Ukraine. It seemed like some promises were made, or not made, but put out there for some increased weapons for Ukraine, and then that got pulled back. Really, that's not going to end until enough pressure is put on Russia to decide that they can't continue to continue that fight. You know, the basic problem is that, having been the aggressors and the invaders, they don't want to give up the territory they've seized. That would probably be pretty devastating to Putin and his hold on power to have started this war. All the lives lost of Russian soldiers. And they just pull back with nothing to gain. At the same time, Ukraine doesn't want to give up that sovereign territory of its own country. And until we can get some meeting of minds around that, it's really hard to see how this war is going to end without one side or the other, or perhaps both, being exhausted by the struggle, which in some ways doesn't seem so far off. In the meantime, the death and destruction continues. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're going to turn to a more local story. Our reporter, Danny Nesvadarani, went down to the Museum of Vancouver to speak with the curator of their new exhibition, Living with Long COVID.
Long COVID is a chronic medical condition that can consist of long-term and sometimes debilitating health issues as the result of a previous COVID-19 infection. The Museum of Vancouver's newest exhibit documents the everyday lives of people living with the condition, which, according to Statistics Canada, has now affected up to 1 in 9 Canadians. The exhibition is simply titled Living with Long COVID. For this exhibition, the Museum of Vancouver collaborated with researchers from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Health Sciences and the Post-COVID-19 Interdisciplinary Clinical Care Network. The exhibition is primarily photography-based, with clusters of pictures and text provided by individuals living with long COVID who agreed to participate in the exhibition. To find out more about what the exhibition entailed, CJSF visited the Museum of Vancouver, where we were able to speak with Viviane Gosselin, the museum's curatorial lead. The first question we asked was, how did this exhibition and collaboration with SFU and the Clinical Care Network come to be?
Yeah, so excellent question. I will say that about half our exhibitions are proposed by people, partners, organizations outside the Museum of Vancouver. So, so we remember receiving a call from the Faculty of Health Sciences. So Rakib Tesfaye, who's a researcher there, approached us and just called me by saying, we work with long haulers, like so people living with long COVID, and doing research on the subject, and yet working with long haulers, they have told us that they feel invisible and would like to work on something public where they can express themselves and talk about this issue.
Next, we asked what the community response has been like so far for this exhibition on living with long COVID.
I will say for the long haulers, when they come here, and we met quite a few actually on opening day, and the general sense was they were pleased and happy to see themselves, even though they had not necessarily participated in and submitted photos for the project. They saw themselves, they felt heard, felt seen. So that was, that was very positive, because that was like one of the goals. The other goal was public awareness, right? Like destigmatize also the topic of long COVID, because it is misunderstood. People don't want to talk about it, or people feel judged because people are if they're talking about their symptoms, because there's not a lot of public education on the topic, these individuals feel that like the message they get is it's all in your head. You should try to do some yoga and a bit of exercise and you'll feel better.
We then asked what reactions they've received from individuals attending this exhibition that may not have been informed about long COVID beforehand.
There's, members of the public who, really hadn't planned to see an exhibition on long COVID, but just stumbled upon it. And we hear their comments, we do some tracking, and we can see people are surprised. Again, they're surprised by how little they knew about the condition. And also about the severity of the condition. Like the people who submitted, the vast majority are homebound, and their daily life has changed radically since getting COVID and living with the aftermath. And for people in the public health sector, I hope it's going to be a bit of a shakeup, right? Like when museums are partnering with research centers in making this more public, it means that it has to be felt in like daily practitioners, like physicians should know more about it. And also it is underdiagnosed, right? So if practitioners, health practitioners are more attuned, they may be able to refer their patients to specialists and support them in their healing or just kind of stabilizing their condition.
Afterwards, we asked Gosselin if she could go over some of the experiences depicted by those living with long COVID who submitted photos and text for this exhibition.
But part of this project, it's a photo-based project, it's about self-documentation and representation, and we said that part of the constraint, if you want, is document your day, and you can submit one and up to 6 images for that day, right? And so what I guess strikes me is when people are making reference to their life before, like everything that they were doing, and how, for example, now just going and walking a short walk around the corner, or just walking your dog for 15 minutes will completely like drain them. They have to go back to bed, right? So so that's struck me, is how their life has been, like, kind of their day-to-day life has been, like, the life, their universe has shrunk, if I can say it that way. But at the same time, we see great efforts to, you know, figure out how to feel better, document their conditions, like a lot of kind of resourcefulness, and they know that they have this one appointment, and like prepping and researching and trying to understand best they can, like, so a lot of agency in that, like kind of trying to take some control over their condition. And yeah, looking at when I keep seeing like pets, like dogs and cats, I think provides great comfort to people who have them. Like it's something that they mention. It's like, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have, you know, so and so. So I think that presence is, alleviates, if you want, some of the symptoms at times. But we also see these photos where someone made little stars out of like the many pills and supplements they have to take. So a lot of people are showing their bottles of you know, medication and you know, prescribed and not prescribed, and creating their own, you know, cocktail. And again, this is not filtered by a medicalized eye. This is very much the lived experience of long haulers. So we're not saying, hey, this is your treatment. Like for those who, this is them sharing what they're living. And I think whether you're from, you know, like you're a researcher or a scientist or just a member of the public, I think essentially we're asked to bear witness. And you know, if people had not given any thought about this issue, this is the time to think about what that means. And given the high number of Canadians, so 1 out of 9 has experienced long COVID, thinking about our, you know, our friends and neighbors, and like, guaranteed, Danny, that you know people who are living with long COVID. And so how can we help? Is there, you know, how can we support these people?
Lastly, Vivian Gosling left us with what she hopes people are able to take away from the Living with Long COVID exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver.
I'd say come, and I'm in awe with the courage and honesty of long haulers. I, you know, have deep admiration, and yeah, I'm humble, and I hope that people will come, because the more we get to understand the experience of these people, but also the context and the condition, because there's our partners at SFU had produced short texts about what is long COVID and what are the symptoms and the kind of impact it has. I think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves.
Once again, that was our conversation with Vivian Gosling, the curatorial lead for the Museum of Vancouver, on the Living with Long COVID exhibition, which is up until March 22nd, 2026. This has been Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that report. In a couple of minutes, we'll be up with a report about Truth and Reconciliation in Wet'suwet'en territories, particularly focused on youth. But first, This is a song from Canadian band Tops. They are currently number one on the National Campus Community Radio charts at earshotonline.com. This is Stars Come After You. Stars Come After You from their album By the Key, number one across Canada on campus community radio stations nationwide. You can check out more of what's getting a lot of attention on community radio at the Earshot charts. You can find those at earshot-online.com. Weekly charts go up every Wednesday. and monthly charts and others, and you can see what each station is doing as well. So check that out. Next story up comes from CICK Radio in Smithers, and they're following truth and reconciliation efforts in Wet'suwet'en territory, and how to carry culture and history forward to youth. Here's a report from Patty Hasen.
Now recognized as a National Day of Remembrance, September 30th has become a day to learn and to listen. I joined a procession of people in Wet'suwet'en to learn about the community's response to the drug overdose epidemic that has taken 54 lives in 7 years in the community. This is the voice of community councillor Warner Nazel on a chilly but bright day on Tuesday.
So what we plan on doing today is we have a march that we're going to do through the community. We're going to start here, work our way up. The subdivision is going to Jamie's place. We'll stop in the corner there. We'll do a prayer circle and maybe some songs. We'll go in front of the apartment buildings. We're going to do a prayer there as well. And we're going to ask Doug and Sherry to lead the prayers. We're going to have drummers here. We're then going to move over to Laura's house where Warren passed away. And we're going to erect a cross there. His family is carrying the cross. They'll carry the cross to that site. We're going to erect the cross, set it up there. We'll do a prayer and words of support for the family who were left behind.
On September 30th, a gathering of nearly 100 people marched together to bring awareness to the effects of colonization on the generations following residential school survivors and family members.
Because a lot of people were hurt and damaged by drug abuse in the last 10 years in a whole neighborhood. So we're going to offer prayers for people in that neighborhood to heal from that. Because often, one of the big things that we struggle with in our community is paralysis from trauma. When we lose somebody from drug abuse, we almost don't know what to do. We're in shock. So this march today is to shake that shock off so we're not standing there in shock all the time because of the losses that we've experienced. We want to begin doing something. We can't stand here and be in shock our whole life. At some point, we have to get moving. We have to pray. We have to do activities to help the healing happen in our community. All of our families have struggled too long. Many of us, the people who passed away through the community, we're going to recognize them, and we're going to offer healing to everybody who struggles with this.
Warner Nazel led the march, and with a committee, organized the sites that we would visit. The people walking and driving were elders, community counselors, chiefs, families who have lost loved ones to overdose or to drug-related deaths, children, aunties, uncles, and neighbors.
One of the reasons why we picked today to do the walk to address the drug crisis on Truth and Reconciliation Day is because I'm a frontline worker. I work in Hazleton, and I help a lot of people who are struggling with drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And every time I talk with my clients, I try and get to the root of the problem. Where did it all start? And often they'll talk about traumas that they've experienced in their life. Could be like really heavy traumas. They've experienced that in their lives. And the people who caused that trauma on them, I ask them to name them. And I then ask them, where did they get that trauma from? Because it's not something that comes natural. They have to mention the next person that's in line. They said, oh, I had a grandpa or I had a great uncle who was really mean all the time. And he used to do stuff. My family always talked about it. Okay, where do you think he got it from? And it always goes back to any residential schools. Everybody who suffers from trauma in their communities, from drug abuse, the other kinds of trauma that we all know about, that all started from Indian residential schools. So we connected the two dots. The drug crisis that we're struggling with here today is as a result of what happened to our children in Indian residential schools. Some of those children survived, and they brought back trauma. They brought back trauma that they learned. And they passed it down generation to generation. And that trauma is still very much alive in our community. So what we want to do is shine a light in a dark space.